is episode 51, and so welcome back. This week will be a little different, with a planned and unplanned story. The unplanned story is one that I posted in part on Facebook. For those who don't follow me on Facebook, the story is about an incident that happened this week that occurred and serves as an example of some of the ways that are challenging in our society, specifically for Asian Americans. In addition, well, this is 2023, and the story is both sadly true, and the ending was one of the most surprising experiences that I've ever had. I was helping a friend walk his dog. Now, Ori is a pretty cool black lab, and like all dogs, he thinks the walk time is for him, and he gets to explore wherever he wants to go. Okay, he's right. I have fun teaching him things that his owner doesn't find amusing. It's kind of like the story last week about my godson. Yes, here I go on a tangent. I taught him how to turn right and left on command. This way I'm not pulling on him in one direction when he wants to go in another. He turns and just continues his exploring, and he follows those instructions about 99% of the time. More than once, there has been applause because at intersections, I'll say, Ori right, Ori cross, and then Ori right or left. Why do I use cross at intersections? It's so that he knows that we're not going to stop at the intersection. Anyway, I'm walking Ori on a sidewalk, and it's a narrow sidewalk. Ori stopped abruptly because, well, there's a tree he hasn't marked lately. The person behind me also had to stop abruptly, and he was obviously following me, maybe too close. As he passed me, he said loud enough to ensure that I heard, "Why don't these people go back to where they came from?" "What?" I blurted out, "You're a racist." Now that might have been cruel, but it was true. Surprisingly, he said, "Yep, I am." As he passed, his cap had the word veteran on the back of it. Now, this guy was easily my age or probably a little bit older. I did notice that there was a young woman up ahead of us, and I don't know how far in terms of distance, but it was maybe an eighth to a quarter of a block. I made no never mind. She was minding her own business, and we continued our walk. It was about a block and a half to the corner, and then we turned down toward Ori's house. The young woman, who was clearly a Gen Z person, actually caught up to me and said, "I want to talk to you." She said, "I heard what the man said when he harassed you. Are you okay?" I said, "Yes." And then she said, "I'm very sorry that he said what he did. It's not okay." I thanked her and she went on her way. Now, she came back quite a few blocks, as I said, just to tell me that, and she didn't need to do it. Her compassion took over and wanted to make sure that I was okay. And I really wasn't. When these things happen, and I've experienced them more times than I want to talk about, your body tenses up and you actually have other reactions with your body, and you're actually physically ill, not sick, but you're obviously shaken. It was about a day plus before I was feeling better, because while it's not a physical attack, it is an attack, and it actually hurts. This past weekend, there was a human rights lawyer on a show, and she mentioned by chance there are more hate crimes against Jewish people than anyone else in America, and Asian Americans are next. Now, I didn't know that. From my lens, what is remarkable is that when there is an attack on others, it is generally ignored by the press unless it's a white-on-black crime. Yes, sometimes others do find their ways onto the news cycle, and it's never a headline. So what do I hope my listeners take away from this story? Well, there are and remains overt and hidden hate and discrimination in our world. There are more, far more people like that young woman whose antenna are up and saw, or heard rather, what actually happened. You've heard me quote this before, and Cinderella's mom was right then, and she's right now. Have courage and be kind. The planned story this week is that Tuesday was the anniversary of my arrival to the United States. All of you know this from the first episode, just 79 days old on a one-way international flight from a trash can to the land of opportunity. I can't say that I remember this every year. I do think about it most years, though, because it is memorable in my mind. I still think about what my life would have been in Korea through the 1960s and 1970s when I was growing up. In Korea, then, per capita income was just over $100. Yes, a year. This was a period of growth past that when President Park came into office. By 1979, their per capita income was over $1,500 because of President Park's economic initiatives. And it wasn't until the 1990s that Korea has become the economic global powerhouse that it is today. So life would have been difficult for an orphan who didn't get adopted and became an adult. Adopted to parents who had natural-born children, they didn't see a difference among their children. By almost any measure, we didn't have a typical childhood. Yet in more ways than not, in hindsight, I'm glad that was the case. Yet the biggest challenge for me has almost always been a naivete, especially as a young adult. And perhaps that's why when I've been physically or verbally assaulted, it came as a shock, as I talked about in the story today. I'm actually going to post a video turning the pages of my Korean passport. I've posted pictures of some of them before, and maybe you'll find it interesting. I do. I have one stamp. There are two names. Apparently, I wasn't employed, and the passport shows a specific destination to the United States. It's also noted that I didn't bring any minor children with me. I was traveling solo. You'll see from the stamp in my passport that it was the sole purpose of permanent residency. It's written right on the stamp. It's truly one of my most prized possessions, evidenced by the worn cover and pages, because I've gone through it so many times. Several of my listeners are adoptees, and many from Holt. Their story is for them to tell. I'm sure you do remember the interviews with Joanne, an adoptee who I met on her homeland tour. And I've been back to Korea beyond my assignment at Osan with the Air Force. I don't have many stamps in my passports from Korea, as they don't do that anymore. I do have amazing memories. I'm on a number of Facebook groups of adoptees who want to learn more about their past and especially their birth relatives. Some have been successful and some not. I have never wondered because I knew my start. I also know there is zero chance I could ever find them and less than a zero chance that I would have a desire to do so. Now, where did we leave off? Oh, yes, I've made my decision to apply for an Air Force ROT instructor position with my eye on the University of Texas at Austin. Last week, I mentioned how the assignment process worked uniquely different from normal assignment processes because you only have to take the assignment for a university or college that you want to go to. That makes sense. We do not want officers with the very important job of nurturing the future officer corps and represent the Air Force on campus if they don't want to be there. So after a zillion calls, well, maybe less, to the assignment officer, it was recommended to only list those places you want to go. Perfect. I listed one place, the University of Texas at Austin. So if you were competing for that institution and listed two places, they would send the person to their second choice so they could fill both slots. They would fill one slot with the clever person who only put one place and the other person with more flexibility. The University of Texas at Austin is a very competitive slot. And surprise, I got the assignment. So now it's time to wrap up my time on the air staff and start thinking about Austin. ROTC rotations are well known and the process is far enough in advance that you do have time to think about the move, because they need to fill all the slots before the fall semester starts. I don't recall exactly how much time was in between that, but it was at least 6 and maybe 8 months. Because of the timeline that I laid out last week, since I got the school I wanted, I was seriously thinking about retiring after the assignment. After my first visit to check out the local area and start my house hunting, my mind was set. I'm probably going to retire, because I did figure that I would find a job at the University of Texas afterwards, and was comfortable with the plan to live there. At the same time, I did have work to do on the Air Staff. In a similar way to my work across DoD with financial programs and the lodging program within Focus 2000, I worked across the services on education and training. The scope of Air Force services was far different than that of the Army, Navy, or the Marine Corps. While their MWR was fashioned much like the Air Force before the merger, there were some differences. For the former services functions, it was very differently aligned as well with regard to the wartime and peacetime missions. The purpose of working across the services was to initially focus primarily on the wartime missions. Even with that, there were differences, and the idea was not necessarily to change the mission, but rather to see how our education and training programs could become more joint or more utilized across the services. So we formed a joint education and training committee. Because of the organizational structure, I was the lone Air Force representative, just because primarily the way that we were organized. The other services had one and some two representatives, and then we invited DoD along as well, because that also just made sense. We met every 4 months or so initially to get an agenda in place. We'd meet at various locations around the country, rather than just in Washington, for two reasons. The first was that the Navy's education and training organizations were outside D.C., and we would also add strap hangers from the bases or second-level headquarters when we were close by. When the Air Force hosted, we held most of our meetings in San Antonio at the Air Force Services Agency, because they were the implementation arm of education and training, as I mentioned last week. When the Navy hosted, we usually were at Coronado in San Diego, which is a beautiful place. And it was very interesting because driving in D.C. is always a bucket of fun. Driving on and off Coronado was always backed up, and if I remember correctly, there was a toll only one way. So that added time and the chance to back up the traffic. The most significant result of our group was to implement joint training by DoD for training for food and beverage operations. This reduced the number of overlapping courses and saved quite a bit of money across the services, and for the Air Force, we cut our costs by 25%. By now, all of you probably know that I'm a bit outspoken, and I very strongly believe that the rules should be followed, especially the rules that are part of an official record. At some point before I got to the Air Staff, the Office of Performance Reports changed from a scale, I think it was 0 to 9, to does meet or does not meet standards. I remember at the time, we're all thinking, how is that really a rating? Because normally, in fact, 99% of people are going to meet the minimum standard. Now, during this time, we also went from narrative assessments to just bullet statements, and for captain, the assessment stops with the first general officer in the chain. So when you're on the Air Staff, when you are so close to the director, you don't have an additional rater as a company grade officer. Another addition was that there's supposed to be feedback to the officer about the midpoint of the rating period, and it's documented on the performance report. This is important so that there are no surprises, and the officer can self-correct if they need to. When the performance feedback is completed, it's actually also noted on the appraisal. I have one appraisal from when I was on the Air Staff that has a documented correction that says corrected copy by the Air Force Personnel Center, and it's actually signed by somebody along the margin. This is because they said the feedback was performed, and at last it wasn't performed. Because it wasn't performed, you have to say why it wasn't performed. And so I had my supervisor made that documentation. And he was agreeable because he knew that it wasn't done. It wasn't that it was a bad report.
It was a glowing report.
Now they have an appraisal from someone on the Air staff that doesn't comply with the Air Force policy. And that didn't go over well with, well, somebody. So we had a lot of conversations, and there was a commitment that feedback sessions for all officers would be better managed. And I agreed they could remove that from my appraisal. And there's a process for that all the way up to the Air Force Personnel Center, which is the management for all official records. So anyway, if you're thinking, why did you do that? Well, you're probably right. I probably didn't have to do that. In my mind, it was an official record. Just as I had two medals rescinded because they didn't meet the Air Force rules, official records should be accurate. In this case, if the Air Force felt so strongly that feedback was necessary and it had to be documented on the appraisal, then it should be properly done, especially, in my mind, on the Air staff. The next appraisal said, quote, Tom is in the top 1% of captains I have known in my 35-plus years in the Air Force, unquote. I wonder if I hadn't started that kerfuffle, I might have been in the top 0.5%, I say, with an evil grin. Although he did finish with, he never let me down. Let's see. Okay, that might have been true. Anyway, my time on the Air staff is coming to an end. Just over 5 years, only two more than it's supposed to be with those extensions. Anyway, it was one of the best jobs in terms of scope of the job and the ways that I got to be part of setting a long-term impact for my career field, as well as a couple times across DOD. I met some amazing senior leaders, and I wish I could have stayed longer. Alas, it was time to get ready for Austin. On the second house hunting trip to Austin, I decided that if I really planned to retire there, I might as well buy a house. In 1997, the traffic was already bad, and it's much worse today. I don't like a long commute to work, and at the time, the largest homeowners association was called Circle C Ranch. Circle C from the university was straight down Mopac, just over or just under 10 miles, so that wouldn't be a very long commute at all. The road called Mopac was parallel, or rather still is, parallel to I-395, and less traffic because there weren't any trucks allowed on it, and the exit for Lady Bird Johnson Wildlife Center was the turnoff to Circle C. It's a very nice community, and a new section was being built. So looking at my timeline to move, there was a spec home that was getting ready for construction and would be ready about that time. It was a beautifully planned community, and the house that was being built was within my price target. What I liked most about the home was that it would easily work for small gatherings, which I expected would be the case since I was working at the university. So that was it. I was going to have that home built, retire, and live happily ever after. Since the home was already approved to start construction, I was buying it just in time. And I had the option of choosing how the home would look, from the outside brick or stone, and all the way down to what color each wall plate was going to be. I also got to pick the shrubbery that was going to be outside and the landscaping, because the homeowners association had very established rules on what could be planted and what couldn't be planted. It was exciting and daunting at the same time, since this was the first time that I ever had a home built. The only thing that I could not change was the floor plan of the home, and I'm glad I didn't have to do that. The floor plan included 3 bedrooms, 2 bathrooms, a dining room, den, living room, formal dining room, sunroom that was a breakfast nook, kitchen, deck, and a 2-car garage. There was a back deck because the piece of land that it was sited on had a huge slope, so the foundation was quite high in the back of the house. The backyard was fenced as well, and it was going to be very nice. I committed to a couple of trips back to Austin to work with the interior and external designers. While this had to be done in pretty short order, I knew I could get away to take care of it. I was surprised how many choices I had to make for almost every single thing in the house. My first choice was the stone for outside, and I picked Austin stone. And if you haven't seen Austin stone, It's beautiful. It has glimmering specks in it, and I was really hoping to get that. I was willing to pay the premium because it is so pretty. Alas, my neighbor had already selected Austin Stone, and you can't have two houses in a row with Austin Stone. Now, I thought that was in the Bill of Rights, the freedom to choose any exterior stone you wish. Alas, no. So the designer suggested a white brick, and that sounded like it would be okay. And she said, "What are you going to do about the grout?" And I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "You're going to want to get matching white grout, because if you use any other color, it's going to look odd." I'm thinking to myself, I think you're right. Then she mentioned, "Oh, now the white grout is an add-on." And I thought, well, okay, how much can grout be? Well, grout is sold by the linear foot, and it's a big house. So I scrapped that whole idea, and I picked a tan brick, which turned out to be quite nice. There was carpet to select, cabinets, paint, fixtures, appliances, wall plate colors, granite, and oh my goodness, can the madness stop? The one piece of advice that I was given by my realtor was, when picking out inside fixtures and colors, take the sample outside and look at it in the natural sun, because the fluorescent lighting in the showroom will not be the same as in your home, and my house was going to have a lot of windows. I did that for the most part. But then I got so tired of picking stuff, one of the last items was the color of the stone around the fireplace. I was really thinking, whatever. I wasn't planning on using the fireplace anyway. Alas, that was the one mistake. Well, there's another one coming up. The stone I chose, not looking at it in the sunlight, had a tint of pink to it. And it wasn't awful. It did stand out. I actually found a picture that I'll post in the episode photos. At the time, the two colors that I had most in my apartment were cranberry and hunter green. So I put a nice hunter green backsplash in the kitchen, and I had the trim and the front door cranberry. If you've ever been to or lived in Texas, I dare say that 99% of the homes have a tan beige trim outside and a very neutral color front door. My realtor told me that the painters really liked my house because they got to use a little color. And I found photos of my house currently on Google Maps, and after 26 years, no one has changed the color, and it still, I think, looks really good, especially with the tan brick. As far as the outside landscaping, I planted red-tip photinias along the back of the house, which by now are probably a zillion feet tall. Okay, maybe not a zillion. And by the front door, I put in rosemary shrubs so I could just step out and pick fresh herbs. Plus, they smell nice. Oh, by the way, they also grow very fast. The one thing that wasn't included was a sprinkler system. It's in Texas. I asked about that, and they said I could have one installed ahead of putting in the sod, which is one of the last things that they do. I would have to pay for it in advance and sign a waiver that if the sale doesn't go through, the builder owned it without repayment. Sure, that smart decision outweighed the fireplace stone. I go to Austin 3 or 4 times to check the house being built. I remember going by it when the foundation was poured and the pipes are sticking out of the ground, and it looks really small. Then I saw it with just a frame up, and again, I'm thinking, this isn't a very big house, because it doesn't look that big when you see all the land and the outside before it's built. Anyway, long story short, it came out the right size. But there was one other boo-boo that I found as soon as I walked in the front door. Now, my grandparents' house in Elmville had white carpet. I remember it well, and it was beautiful. And this is the first time that I'm buying carpet for a house. So I make the command decision to put in white carpet. It's not off-white carpet, it's white carpet. Now, if you're thinking that must have been very hard to keep clean, I'm telling you, When you spill sugar or flour, it really doesn't show. The kitchen was in the center of the main part of the house, and so when I did have to entertain, and I did, when you're in the kitchen, you can look out, and to your right, you see the dining area in the sunroom, and to the left, the formal dining room. And it really did work out quite nicely. All in all, it was a very good experience, and I really did enjoy living in that home while I was in Austin. I make the move from Washington to Texas in April of 1997, and the good news is the home was completely ready to move into with no waiting when I got there. Next week, we'll start one of my favorite assignments of my time in the Air Force, and I think you'll see why. Thank you again, as always, for tuning in. Have a great week, and remember, have courage and be kind.